Recorded on location at Aspen Ideas Health in Aspen, Colorado.
We're on location, Aspen Ideas Health, with Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent for KFF Health News and host of its podcast, What the Health.
I think this may be the first time that, abortion rights drives people out to vote. The anti-abortion movement has always been sort of the ones that have been able to, gin up their base, and the people who are sort of on the most extreme of the anti-abortion movement are the most devoted and the most likely to vote. That's a big reason why Republicans have courted them so assiduously, is because they show up and they vote.
Decisions made in Washington affect everyone's health care, from reproductive rights to the cost of medication. Julie Rovner is here to provide insights and analysis as we head toward Election Day.
Former President Trump, and I don't mean this in a negative way, I would actually like to ask him if he knows the difference between Medicare and Medicaid, and whether he feels as strongly about preserving Medicaid as he has said he does about Medicare. That is honestly, if I had 5 minutes with him, that is the question I would ask him.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Julie Rovner, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, let's start asking you about the Supreme Court. We're just a week away in this recording from when their final results will come out, final rulings. Tell us what you are watching in terms of the Supreme Court and other issues around their thinking about healthcare.
Well, they could go into July, by the way, because I think they have 12 or somewhere between 12 and 15 cases left. And occasionally they slide into that next week. But we expect most of the decisions next week. There are two cases that I'm watching pretty closely. One of them is an abortion case. It's about the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, or EMTALA, which requires hospitals to provide emergency care to people who present at their emergency rooms, even if they don't have insurance. It was passed in 1986 in order to stop patient dumping, to stop them from turning people away at the emergency room. But if a woman comes in distress, obviously, complications of pregnancy, and needs an emergency abortion, the Biden administration has said, you must do that. And the state of Idaho has passed a law that said, nope, unless the woman is actually dying, and there is some space between women in, at risk of losing their fertility, of losing limbs, of, moving towards death, but not quite on death's door. So we're waiting to see whether the Supreme Court is going to say that the federal law overrides the Idaho law, or whether the Idaho law is allowed to stand while the federal law stands. So that's sort of the big health-related case that I'm waiting for. The other case that affects everything is a case about something called Chevron doctrine, which sounds super nerdy and is super nerdy. And basically what it says is, when Congress passes a law, the administration, the agencies of the federal government are the experts, and generally whatever when they put out regulations to implement these laws, unless there's something that's egregiously wrong with it, arbitrary and capricious, that deference should be given to the agency's interpretation. And there are a lot of people, particularly on the right, who worry about the deep state and all of the people in the, career people in the federal bureaucracy, that they would like that not to be the case anymore. And there is a case about herring fishing in Rhode Island that's asking the court to actually overturn Chevron deference. It should be one of the last cases, I imagine, that we will see out of the Supreme Court before they leave for the summer. So that's kind of the big
inklings,
one.
Usually they're asked in their nomination about different things. Is Chevron one of those things that's on the list of?
It will be going forward.
It will be, right.
I'm trying to remember I don't know that it even came up when Amy Coney Barrett was sort of the last one who I don't think they would have asked Justice Jackson about Chevron deference. I think they probably know what she would have said. But I mean, it could tie the hands of the federal bureaucracy in many, many ways if the court overrules this, assumption, basically, that the experts in federal agencies know whereof they speak.
Well, both of those situations are cause for a lot of concern. The first, in the very real case, and we've been hearing this, of women who present at emergency rooms, not even necessarily death's door, but very, very much at risk. So thank you for flagging that, and also the Chevron doctrine. I want to talk about another issue that we're all hearing a lot about, the court's decision to preserve the status quo for mifepristone, the medication abortion, as I think the American public has come to learn about over these past months. We don't really think this is the end of the debate, do we? Advocates expect to launch other efforts to restrict it, as has been done in Louisiana.
Well, actually, this effort isn't even dead. What the Supreme Court did was they said that the doctors, and I think one of them was a dentist, who sued to say that they were somehow injured, even though they don't prescribe the abortion pill, by the existence of the abortion pill. The court said unanimously, no, you cannot show enough hurt, enough injury from this to have standing. However, and when the case now goes back to Texas, there are three states that where the attorneys general have also sued on different grounds, and that so it could be revived, just this case with those states back at the district court level before Judge Kaczmarek in Amarillo. Huh.
Julie, you've written the book on healthcare coverage here in Washington, D.C., and I'm wondering if we're at the high water mark for Congress in getting involved in sort of specific healthcare decisions. I'm thinking about the Senate Republicans blocking IVF access bill, which I don't think many Americans really thought was a controversial issue.
No, they didn't. Although I will say back in 2011 and 2012, there was the beginnings of what we call the personhood movement, where there were some people who are, I will say, out on the fringe of the anti-abortion movement who wanted to have state laws declaring personhood, that when an egg and sperm come together and fertilized, it is a person with full legal rights. Even at the time, the anti-abortion, sort of the people who were pushing to overturn Roe v. Wade, were trying to tell these personhood people
too soon,
go away. There was actually a vote in Mississippi and it went down. There were a couple of votes here in Colorado and it went down, but it's nothing new. It's nothing that we've seen before. So when this Alabama Supreme Court decision came down on IVF, basically saying that these embryos now are potentially people, I think that shook a lot of people up. Because Republicans, of course, have been saying ever since Roe fell that we're not coming after, you know, your birth control, we're not coming after IVF. But there are segments of the anti-abortion movement that are coming after birth
control.
Why the
quick reversal? All politics, all thinking about the presidential election, the reversal
of the Republicans, or the reversal of the anti-abortion movement?
Anti-abortion.
I think that this case had been bubbling up, and it sort of, when they won it, it's like, okay, we should go out and do it now. And it's true that the anti-abortion movement never has viewed the overturn of Roe as the end of their fight. They've viewed it as the beginning of their fight. They've viewed it as what has allowed them to go into each state and see how far they can push.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been some interesting and frightening writing about how well organized and longstanding this campaign was to get to exactly this point. It gives you pause about the talent that got people to a place that we might be very concerned about. But, you know, with this election year, there is so much that people are going to consider. I think you've noted 15 states will consider abortion-related ballot initiatives, but also funding for mental health services, firearm-related taxes, mm-hmm. probably firearm control, which we had a chance to talk with Admiral Levine about today. I'm sorry, with Gregory Jackson today, who we spoke to earlier this morning. Financing for long-term care and health care for low-income families. So those seem like all areas that, you know, are worthy of debate. But what are you thinking we're going to see in terms of this being these are the issues that drive people out to vote?
I think this may be the first time that abortion rights drives people out to vote. The anti-abortion movement has always been sort of the ones that have been able to gin up their base, and the people who are sort of on the most extreme of the anti-abortion movement are the most devoted and the most likely to vote. That's a big reason why Republicans have courted them so assiduously. It's because they show up and they vote. So, you know, a lot of Republicans, and they're saying this publicly, it's like, well, I never thought Roe would get overturned. So, you know, it seemed safe to say that I would support what they wanted. And now they're in this box where they see things like IVF with 80% public popularity. But, you know, they have promised these evangelical and, you know, other anti-abortion groups that they would support this, and they're in a real bind.
Okay, we're less than a week out from the presidential debate, And
maybe.
Well, it's scheduled. CNN is doing a lot of promotion on it. And
I won't believe it till they both walk out on the stage.
They may be walking out on different stages. But what would be the one question you'd like to ask around health policy to former President Trump and President Biden?
Former President Trump, and I don't mean this in a negative way, I would actually like to ask him if he knows the difference between Medicare and Medicaid, and whether he feels as strongly about preserving Medicaid as he has said he does about Medicare. That is honestly, if I had 5 minutes with him, that is the question I would ask him.
Mm-hmm. And how about President Biden?
I'd like to ask President Biden how he came to where he is on abortion and reproductive health. It's not a secret. Obviously, yeah. I covered him in the 1980s when he was, he wasn't one of those Democrats who was strongly anti-abortion. There have been several of those, but he was never comfortable with it.
Sure.
And obviously, over the years, things have changed. There was a website that, you know, was sort of deriding him when he was president. You know, he didn't say the word abortion until like a year and a half into his term. He still only said it a handful of times. It's clearly something he's not particularly comfortable with. Mm-hmm. But obviously, he, you know, is pushing his administration to do things that the abortion rights side would like. And when he talks about it, I mean, it seems fairly clear that he believes it. So I'd love to know how that sort of rolled out over many, many years of his thinking about the issue.
Right.
Well, I imagine you'll get the life story as well as the adult pivotal events.
Always.
Story will be very fascinating. Probably be a long answer. Very fascinating. You've studied what a second Trump presidency would look like for healthcare. What are the big takeaways for you on that from your reporting?
Well, it's a good question. There is this Project 2025 that's been put together it's been spearheaded by the Heritage Foundation, but a lot of other groups have contributed to it. And it's basically a Republican wish list of everything they would like to do on health. I mean, on every issue, but there's a big section on health and work requirements for Medicaid, and I think block granting Medicaid and turning Medicare into, you know, even more privatized than it is now. If Trump was elected, he would actually do those things. It's hard to know. I mean, the other part of Project 2025 is that they are vetting people who would like to come into the administration and do some of these things. So there's a probably better than 50-50 chance on a lot of these things, but that's certainly something that we would be looking at. Trump himself, obviously, when he was president, did talk a lot about drug prices. It's something he feels strongly about. He did talk about preserving Medicare and Social Security. Basically, I think he knew what a hot button issue it was and didn't want to get into it. We'll see if that would still be the same as we get. At some point, Congress has to do something about Social Security and Medicare if we would like them to still be there.
Right.
So you can't tuck them forever.
I'm wondering, I was taking a look at it, and I did know who Roger Severino is, who wrote the 50-page sort of piece on the healthcare. But it seemed like they were talking a little bit about breaking up the CDC, certainly the expanding Medicare Advantage as well. They had a number of details in there. I was kind of surprised that out there, nothing around the safety net. But around
Roger Severino was in the first Trump administration. He was the head of the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Health and Human Services.
Uh-huh.
He was the person in charge of, you know, saying that anyone who does not believe in abortion should not have to be anywhere near it or family planning or anything else. And a lot of people, you know, the all of the protections for gay and trans people in the Affordable Care Act, they tried to water them down, and obviously a lot of that stuff got reversed. Roger Severino's wife is actually a leader in the anti-abortion movement, been for a long time. So they are longtime conservative activists.
Where are they on the Affordable Care Act? They're sort of dancing around it.
Yeah, I think they're dancing around it.
Yeah, just keep it on the sidelines.
Smart on their part. We're pretty engaged in public health and community health, and the idea that Donald Trump has promised to strip funding from schools that have vaccine requirements, something that probably just about everybody has had as part of their life. That's certainly something to raise some concern that would potentially result in breakouts of measles and mumps and rubella and all sorts of things that the society has not had to deal with. Is this getting the attention that it deserves?
I've given it some attention. It's funny. I've seen him say it. It's a talking point. And what he says is that he won't give a single federal dollar to any schools that have vaccine mandates or mask mandates.
So which is 100% of public schools, to the best of my knowledge.
Right, for vaccine mandates. But in the context of how he's saying it, it seems that he's applying it to COVID. But he's not actually saying that it only applies to COVID. So it's kind of a question mark whether he means all vaccines. Uh-huh. But there's certainly more anti-vax feeling than there has been in quite a long time. Trump, even after he, championed the COVID vaccine, and that was a major accomplishment for the Trump administration, turned that vaccine around in such a short period of time, he immediately started getting pushback from his base, and he sort of backed off of it. So we're not quite sure what he means about the anti-vax. That may be another one of these things where it depends who is running the CDC or who's running HHS.
Julie, in our day job, we run a large federally qualified health center. One thing that we keep an eye on was Medicaid. It obviously had an enormous upswing in terms of people who became eligible. But 15 million people lost eligibility in this Medicaid redetermination. Maybe, I think, 5 or so million got some form of coverage. And the ACA coverage seems to have gone up. Talk a little bit about that and its impact. I'm not sure people know how large the combination of Medicaid and Medicare is in this country. It has a profound impact on health.
Yeah, well, Medicaid at its peak had 90 million people enrolled, which is a number every time I see it, it just kind of boggles my mind. I mean, that's a third bigger than Medicare. Even with, with 15 million fewer people, it's still a lot of people. It's still the largest federal health program, even though it's a federal state health program. And I think there's been a fair bit of attention to this, Medicaid unwinding, as they call it, when states finally, after the public health emergency ended, got to redetermine eligibility for the first time in 3 years. And indeed, many people are no longer eligible. And a lot of those people did either get employer insurance or they got Affordable Care Act insurance. But of course, what we saw is that 75% of the people who lost their coverage lost it for basically paperwork reasons. They either didn't respond to the emails or to the phone calls, or they'd move. Many of these people move frequently, or they didn't return the forms in time. So we know that there are millions of people who are still eligible for Medicaid who nevertheless lost their Medicaid. Mm-hmm. But, in the states that did this fairly methodically and seriously, a lot of them would say, okay, you're no longer eligible for Medicaid, but you are eligible for probably free coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and here's how you can sign up.
Right.
So it depends, we did see that. I mean, I think the big increase in Affordable Care Act coverage was because of these expanded subsidies that Congress did that will expire at the end of next year unless Congress renews them, which I should have mentioned is something that really important depending on who's the next
administration. There's a lot coming up at the end of the year and on that list. And I don't know if this has been on your radar, but certainly along with so many people having coverage for the first time, people had access to telehealth and telemedicine throughout the pandemic. It forced all of us who deliver care to get with the program and make that happen. And patients got used to it pretty readily, telephone and by video. But Medicare says some of those those enhanced provisions will disappear in December unless something changes. How much do you think this has really gotten to be a permanent fixture of the American healthcare system, including the government programs?
Everything I can tell from Capitol Hill is that they would like to renew this, if not permanently, then at least for another couple of years. It is popular, as you say. One of the issues with telehealth, and this has been the issue with telehealth all along about not wanting to expand it, is that they're afraid that it would actually increase costs because it would increase visits. Again, you take out some of that friction of people actually getting medical care and they're going to get more medical care. And at some point they worry about, doctors inducing demand. I mean, there's no question that telehealth is, amazingly helpful, particularly for people who have mobility limitations or distance limitations. But there are indications that it is costing the programs more. And I think that may give some lawmakers a little bit of pause. Maybe they'll renew it with some more restrictions. I don't know. It comes up on Capitol Hill every other week. So, I mean, I think there will be some legislated resolution to it. I'm not sure I would be able to guess what it will be.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about what a second Trump administration might look like. I should note that I think in that mandate for leadership, there was a Medicaid work requirement that also may impose lots of stir the pot in terms of what's happening. But let's talk about President Biden. What do you think will, one, what were his accomplishments in the healthcare arena, and what do you think the second term might look like?
He's gotten a lot more done than I think he's gotten credit for. As I mentioned, there's, you know, millions more people getting Affordable Care Act coverage because of the subsidies. We're going to see just in a couple of months the first 10 negotiated drug prices for Medicare, a $35 a month copay cap for insulin for people with diabetes on Medicare. Next year, we'll see a $2,000 cap, out-of-pocket cap on Part D prescription drugs. I mean, those are big things that people have been trying to do for a really long time. There is something to be said for a president who'd spent, you know, 3 decades in the Congress.
Exactly,
he knows
right.
where the levers are, and he knows how to make them work.
But the timing on that will be after the election, right? Well, the impact on those.
Yes, yeah. the impact on those, because everything takes a long time. So it's healthcare. It's a big boat. It takes time to move
and
it around.
And everybody ideally would like to get credit for
right. And of course, what he would do in a second term will depend on who controls Congress. I mean, it's just so tight. The fact that he's gotten as much accomplished as he has with such a tiny majority, particularly in the Senate, and you know, in the House, even when Democrats controlled the House, it was a very tiny majority. I have to say, and you know, of all the presidents I've covered, I think he's gotten the most accomplished that he wanted to in the most difficult of situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that includes, you know, passing the Affordable Care Act. It's 60 votes in the Senate when the Affordable Care Act passed. They should have been able to pass the Affordable Care Act.
Well, pivoting to a slightly different topic, the Pew Research Center found that about 9 in 10 Americans say marijuana should be legal for recreational or medicinal use. But the use and possession of marijuana is still illegal under U.S. federal law. Do you think we'll see a change in the next 4 years, no matter who's president? Is there enough momentum for that?
I think it's coming. You know, in my home state of Maryland, the governor just basically, you know, canceled all of the sentences for the people who had been convicted of simple marijuana possession. Yeah. That was a big deal. We made recreational marijuana legal in Maryland a couple of years ago. I can't remember whether it was 2020 or 2022, but in the last few years. But that was a big deal. I think it's definitely being thought about. I mean, they're obviously rescheduling marijuana for the purposes of the federal, you know, Controlled Substances Act, which is a very big deal. That's been coming for a while. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be shocked, no matter who's elected, if that happens.
Julie, one of the things that we're really focused in on is primary healthcare systems. And one of the things that we see eroding because of hospital venture-fueled investments that seem to have gone south in terms of that. Talk about what's happening in the venture world, how it might be undermining hospital systems, primary care systems, and the like. What's it look like out there?
I think you have to distinguish between venture capitalists and private equity.
Private equity.
I mean, venture capitalists are people who actually want to come in and invent, you know, and help underwrite cool things and then make money from the profits of those cool things. Private equity, in many cases, as we have seen in the healthcare, wants to come in, buy up something, strip it of its valuable parts, and then sort of leave it for dead on the side of the road, which we have seen, you know, in many
Prospect
hospitals.
And Stewart.
Yes. Yeah. So that it's a very different thing. You know, people, we have a segment of the podcast that we do periodically called This Week in Private Equity and Healthcare, because there are stories about this almost every week. I don't know. There's definitely concern among policymakers. I know certainly Lena Khan at the Federal Trade Commission is concerned about this, but it's hard to know what the federal government can really do. It's something that Congress is looking at and worrying about, but hard to know what it will do. But, you know, actually on our podcast this week, my panelist Margo Sanger-Katz from the New York Times pointed out, you know, we're studying this now, but by the time they study it, if they decide that private equity is a bad thing for healthcare, it's going to be too late.
There are some states that have tougher regulatory
hurdles
for people, and that may be the model, at least in the interim, until the federal situation settles out. And obviously they have a lot of money, the private equity people who are investing in them. But we have seen, I think, it most recently, 21% of the bankruptcies that happened were those that had private equity in them. But you make the distinction between venture. So you're not really seeing venture doing the same thing, let's sell it for its parts, or you really think they're a force for good in terms of the system?
I think the concept of venture capital is a force for good. I cannot speak for all venture capitalists, but certainly the idea, I mean, I know a lot of people from healthcare policy who've gone into venture capital and are doing interesting stuff. You know, let's try this out and see if it works. And that's what venture capital is for. Sure. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Somebody has to try it, so.
Well, I think you're exactly right on the private equity. It may be too late, but on the other hand, where so much of healthcare is a mystery to people, their community hospital is not a mystery. It's an employer, it's a neighbor, it's where people had their babies and, you know, sat by their loved ones while they died. So I think this might turn out to be more of an election issue too.
We'll see.
By the time we get there, if people have more experience with it.
I don't know that people are making the connection yet.
Yet.
I think those of us in healthcare know and see it and worry. And I can't, you know, there's a lot of things the public is worried about, but it's mostly prices and taking 3 months to get an appointment and though, you know, being
primary
shuttled between,
shortages.
Primary care shortages, being shuttled between specialists. They're not at the level of who owns this hospital that's the heart of our community.
Right. It may be coming.
How transformational do you see the GLP-1 drugs being? They're obviously having impact every week. We're seeing a new study released that it has a positive impact on a particular area. What's the horizon look like for that type of?
Everybody, it's funny. I have a contrary view. A lot of people say, oh my God, we're all going to go broke because these drugs are so expensive. It's like when there's 100 of them, they're not going to be that expensive anymore. It's like statins. You know, at some point, statins cost $10 a month. So I think the prices, the ridiculous prices, will come down pretty fast. And certainly the drug companies will make a lot of money because a lot of people are going to be eligible to take these drugs.
They don't for a very long time.
They don't have to be charging, you know, $1,300 a month. But I am told that there are more of these in the pipeline, obviously oral medications rather than injectable medications. I mean, it's going to be a continuing evolution. But I don't think that the dramatic, it's going to break Medicare is probably going to happen.
Julia, here at Aspen, I know you've been very busy, but you were part of a session about life after 50, focused on putting supportive public policies in place for what people call the second half of life. What were you all talking about on your panel? What was interesting to you and what came up?
Well, of course, I am over 50, so I would.
That's
said,
very
I was,
interesting
yes,
to you.
I was very interested. It was mostly based around a book that's coming out from the head of policy at the AARP, who posed sort of 7 questions for people to think about as they look at the second half of life. And they include everything from, where will I live? Will I have enough money to retire? To, how will I die? What about, you know, longevity? How can I live longer? It was a really fascinating, the book is fascinating. It comes out in September, but the panel included, you know, a geriatrician who treats elderly people, someone who basically runs projects to bring the generations together, the author of the book and the head of the Trust for America's Health, who's looking at data around how we treat the aging population. And it was really a very interesting discussion about sort of the changing role of aging. Although I did my first story about our lack of a long-term care policy in this country in 1986. Still, nothing has changed.
Life expectancy.
Yes, life. That's true. Life expectancy
higher.
Has gone up. Our ability to
so we need
provide people
policy.
With long-term care has not.
Well, won't aging be solved by AI?
yeah, maybe.
No, but what are you seeing in the AI field, and are you keeping an eye on that as you sort of do your broad view horizon of what's impacting health policy?
I'm absolutely keeping an eye on AI, but, you know, like most people who are not AI experts, I have no idea what it really means. I mean, I can see sort of the low-level advantages, and not so low-level, you know, doctors could be talking into their computer rather than having to stare at the screen and write, and type. You know, we can have a lot more help for people with various disabilities. They're, you know, much better monitoring, but when you get to sort of some of the big picture things, I mean, I don't think I want to be treated by an AI bot. I'd still rather be treated by a human being. Mm-hmm. I think, like so much technology, and particularly so much technology in the healthcare space, sometimes the technology gets ahead of how useful or how good it actually is. That concerns me.
Well, Julie, health misinformation has been a big topic here at Aspen and KFF Health News has a Health Misinformation and Trust Initiative aimed at tracking health information in the U.S. and analyzing its impact on people. What are you finding so far?
Actually, it's KFF, not KFF Health News. So it's a program. It's a program alongside of KFF Health News. Yeah. But its director sits next to me. So
perfect.
This was something that obviously was a huge concern during the COVID pandemic, of all of the information that was going out that was either not right because it was just, you know, people made a mistake, or deliberately misleading, people trying to sell things that, you know, we knew didn't work, people trying to deter people from obvious public health interventions. So basically, KFF is going to start a misinformation and disinformation dashboard. We're going to keep track of all of this, and keep track of the research that's going on in the field. I think it's really important for us to get involved in this. It's a big problem in healthcare of people, a lot of this information that's responsible for a lot of declining trust in public health and in the healthcare system. It's really a critical issue going forward. So I'm glad we're elevating it.
And I think the intersection is that people don't trust science either. And there's a whole group of people who are trying to work on that to rebuild trust. And that's true in the news media as well. The need to have trusted partners who were out there. But that's been a big conversation here, is that I think people are very anxious that we've lost a generation, may have lost a generation of people who are simply saying, I won't believe what the scientist says. I'm going to look at my TikTok or whatever.
And it's not just science. They don't trust anyone with expertise. Mm. So everybody is sort of losing out. It's like there used to be experts that you could turn to and say, well, that's the person who's spent their career doing this. They should know. And we really don't have that anymore. And you're right. Now it's like, oh, well, I'm going to follow the influencer on TikTok.
Right. We'll have another whole show on science literacy, which is another piece of the fundamental issues that we have. But I want to talk about medical bills for a month. Medical debt, always a big issue, and something that does resonate with people. Insured, uninsured people face the same shock and awe when they see their medical bills. You have a feature on your podcast called Bill of the Month. What have you looked at that you found really either interesting, shocking, or provocative that shed light on healthcare prices in the U.S.?
Well, this is a project a joint project with KFF Health News and NPR that we've been doing, I think, for 5 years now. Definitely, it did, I will say, help lead to the surprise billing legislation that went through Congress. Many of the bills that we had, and some of them were just absurdly outrageous. People who, go to in-network providers and end up with these out-of-network bills, or make, tiny mistakes and end up with these enormous bills. And in most cases, as you can find with your local news, sometimes, getting a call from a journalist will suddenly straighten things out. That has not happened in every case, I will tell you, but it's happened in a lot of cases. And, what's been most useful about this project is not only helping the individuals who, were in a bind with these enormous bills they couldn't possibly pay, but also telling, giving people actionable information, sort of what did this person do that you need to be careful not to do? Because a lot of this is on individual patients. It's the system is so hard to navigate. And when you navigate it wrong, you can end up basically broke. Right.
The more you're responsible for navigation, which is very challenging.
Yes.
One of the more interesting politicians of our time was here, Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. He talked about his struggle with depression, and he was very articulate, I thought, very thoughtful. Mm-hmm. Seemed like he'd found the seam of bipartisanship in terms of the mental health coalition he's put together. What do you think his voice will be able to do in terms of public policy?
Well, he's obviously, a freshman, so he's new to the Senate. But I agree with you. I think he's worked. Pennsylvania obviously is a very closely divided state.
Absolutely.
Have all Democrats in representing them in the Senate and the governor now, but it can switch at any moment. And I think he's of the mind to try to find the things where you can thread that needle and make policy, that you can get things accomplished even if you can't get the big things that you might want to do accomplished. And I think that's what Biden did as a senator. That's what it takes to be an effective senator, is to find those pieces where you can establish a big enough coalition to get something passed. I mean, there's so many people in the Senate now who are just there to yell. And then there are people who are there to actually do the work. And he's one of those people who is clearly there to do the work.
Well, Julie Robner, we thank you so much for your important reporting through the years. We're going to continue to keep learning from your coverage. And we want to thank our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please, we love to hear your thoughts and comments about this program. Julie, thank you so much for your incredible work and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
This was fun.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.